This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We still do not know that there are any confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Michigan. However, when you ask health providers about that, they're quick to say there might be. We just haven't found them yet. A supply of new coronavirus test kits has been extremely short. Last week, Vice President Mike Pence announced the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention was getting ready to ship testing materials for as many as 1 million people over the weekend. Dr. Janae Khaldun is Michigan's chief medical officer. Dr. Khaldun, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me again.
Has Michigan received a sizable shipment of COVID-19 tests from the CDC yet?
Yes, our state laboratory has for several weeks actually been preparing to be able to perform the COVID-19 test. We did receive our initial testing kit, and then last week we received two additional kits. So the message right now to all of our medical providers is, if someone comes to you and you think they meet criteria and they need to be tested, you should work with your local health department to get that testing done. We can provide that in our state lab, but also there are private labs who have already come on board with being able to perform this test. So we do not want people to think today that they cannot get this test if it is necessary.
How many people have been tested in Michigan so far?
We've tested over 50 people here in the state of Michigan at our state laboratory. But I think what's important to mention is we now know that there are other private labs, LabCorp, who are actually providing this test. So a provider does not necessarily have to go to our state lab to do this test. I don't have full insight into what those private laboratories are doing right now. We are working on that system. But as of today, at our state lab, we've tested dozens of people. They're coming in every day. We now have 7-day-a-week operations as far as running those samples. But outside of our state lab, private labs are doing the testing as well.
When we hear that the number of people who have been tested is in the dozens and that the number of people who may be at risk could be in the thousands and that people who are medically fragile might be in the tens of thousands, I mean, how are the labs going to be able to perform enough tests to really get the upper hand on the outbreak?
You're right, April. As this continues, it is actually a concern that we all have as far as long-term, we'll be able to do enough tests for individuals. But right now, we are not saying, based on what we've seen in our lab, our test results, we have not seen one confirmed case. We do not have broad community spread that we know of. And so right now we have a supply, but absolutely that could change. And then we will be looking to not just our state lab, but our private laboratories to be able to take on that capacity.
Do you expect that the CDC is going to send out more materials?
My understanding, and again, I can't speak for the CDC, but my understanding is that if we request additional testing kits, that they will provide them for us. And that did happen last week. We requested kits, and we did receive kits. So as of today, I do not have a supply challenge, but you are absolutely right. As the days go on, and certainly if we see more cases and therefore more people are certain to be at risk and we need more tests, that is something that I hope that the CDC and FDA are working very hard on as far as testing capability.
In states that have confirmed cases of COVID-19, there are a lot of people who've had trouble getting through to their doctor's offices. I mean, phone lines are just jammed. Is there any way that institutions can deal with the tidal wave of people asking if they need to be assessed?
That's a great point. Yes, we are working with our healthcare providers, with our hospitals, making sure they are doing the appropriate screenings, making sure they know that patients may be coming to them. What we don't want, though, is everyone to think that they need to go to an emergency department, for example, if they think they might have symptoms. They need to call their providers, potentially call their local health departments to see what was needed. And we are actively working on expanding capacity, both at the state and the local level, to be able to manage those calls and requests for information.
So in the last 24 hours, a couple of major institutions have canceled in-person classes for the year. Harvard University, Ohio State ended face-to-face instruction last night, just telling students that they need to not come to class. How far are we from seeing disruption on that scale for places of work and schools in Michigan, do you think?
So those are important strategies when it comes to community mitigation. And specifically, as you dial up your strategies and when you are seeing spread in the community of the disease, like many of those areas where you mentioned those universities are, absolutely, those are things that you should consider and implement. We are not there in Michigan right now, today. But again, if I find that there are positive cases, if we are having community spread, then absolutely those are things that we should be implementing and considering. And we are working very closely, actually, with our school and university partners to make sure that they have the information that they need, and we are supporting them as necessary at the state level.
Hmm. What needs to happen to make sure that Michigan's hospitals are not overwhelmed in the event of a large-scale outbreak?
Well, again, we've been working with hospitals for several weeks now, healthcare providers for over a month, making sure they're prepared, making sure they're thinking about what their emergency preparedness plans are, who's going to be able to work, and what they need to do if employees need to stay home.
Are there a series of procedures that hospitals need to devise in terms of finding more available beds at remote locations or drafting additional staff?
Yes, that would be something that every hospital CEO should be thinking about right now, absolutely.
What's the state's responsibility to make sure that the plans hospitals have in place are durable?
So we've been working with all of our healthcare providers to make sure they have the information that they need. We're also working with our licensing and regulatory agency, LARA, to make sure we're supporting our providers to the best we can. And we're also looking at supplies. So if our hospitals were to have shortages of any gowns or gloves or masks, we want to make sure at this state we understand what that need may be. And if we need to request additional funding to support them, we will do that.
Michigan's chief medical officer is Dr. Janae Khaldun. Dr. Khaldun, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's time once again for a state history lesson with our partners at the Michigan History Center. Many Michiganders have heard of the Elliott Larson Civil Rights Act. As a matter of fact, a petition drive is underway this year that would expand the act's protections to include the LGBTQ community. But many of us don't know the people behind those names. Just who is Daisy Elliott? Jillian Reese is a curator of exhibits at the Michigan History Center, and she's with us now. Hey, Jillian, welcome to Stateside.
Hello.
So where was Daisy Elliott from?
She was originally born in West Virginia in 1917.
Do we know why she came to Michigan?
She was looking for economic opportunities. Her father was a coal miner, and her mother was a homemaker. So in many ways, they were sort of the next generation of folks that were not only looking for economic freedom in the North, but also social freedom. This was the time of Jim Crow, when Black folks in the South really didn't have freedom of movement or freedom of political expression. So they looked at the North as sort of this promised land where they could get good jobs, you know, have more freedom. Now, that wasn't always the case. Racism existed everywhere in the United States. They had more freedom than they did in the South. But I'm sure that those experiences in the South and then later in Michigan really inspired Daisy. She was one of these women that after she turned 40, she decided, I want to get more involved in sort of improving the life of women and African Americans in Michigan.
And how did she do that?
Well, she ran for public office. I have been studying a lot about Daisy Elliott, and one of the things that strikes me most about her is, you know, in the last 2018 midterm election, the conversation was really about women getting involved in political life, many of them for the first time and many of them later, sort of spurred on by what they wanted to see in the world and the change they wanted to make. And Daisy Elliott, in many ways, is a foremother of this movement. In 1960, Michigan voters voted to approve a constitutional convention, of which they had to then elect delegates. And Daisy Elliott was a delegate elected from Detroit. It's particularly interesting, the 61-62 Con-Con, that this was the first constitutional convention in Michigan's history where all the delegates weren't white men. We had women delegates and African-American delegates. So it was a very important constitution because for the first time, we were really going to hear a diversity of voices with regards to gender and race.
Daisy Elliott's name would have been important to Michigan's story no matter what. But how did she come to be part of such an important civil rights bill that stays with us to this day?
Yeah, after her experience at ConCon, Daisy Elliott joined other ConCon alums to run for public office in their local communities. And she became a representative in the Michigan House. Right away, she set to representing the needs and improving the lives of women and African Americans throughout the state. She almost immediately knew that she wanted to try and pass legislation that was modeled on the 1964 Civil Rights Act that had passed federally. And it took her almost 10 years to find someone, specifically a Republican. She wanted it to be a bipartisan piece of legislation, and find someone who was willing to co-sponsor that with her. She saw during this time busing, the Detroit riots, racial inequality, sort of the fallout of those things. And she really thought that it was very important for Michigan to have some sort of law on the books that would protect the civil rights of Michiganders.
So the person that she found was Republican Melvin Larson.
Yes.
How did she sell him on being a part of this?
Well, it wasn't too hard of a sell. Mel was sort of a product of his time period. He was much younger than Daisy Elliott. He sort of saw her. He served on the Civil Rights Committee with her and saw her as a leader on that committee. But he also personally had been touched by some of these issues. While working in Pontiac as a teacher, he saw the racial tensions and inequity that had sprung up around busing in that city. And so when he was approached by Daisy, he sort of said, okay, I'll sign up. And in fact, many people within his own Republican caucus warned him against co-sponsoring this piece of legislation. They told him that it would be political suicide. And Mel has talked a lot since then about how he would have probably been sort of this no-name legislator if it wasn't for Daisy Elliott sort of reaching beyond the aisle and allowing him to become famous and an important part of Michigan history.
It's become such a commonly known piece of Michigan history now, but did they have a hard time getting it passed?
It took them quite a few years. I think it was 4 years from the time that Mel signed on as co-sponsor to getting it passed. But I think, you know, during this time period of the 60s and 70s, across the country, there was an incredible sense that people needed to work in a bipartisan fashion to address some of the issues that were being highlighted by the civil rights movement and by the women's liberation movement. And so, you know, there was this sense that Michigan needed to keep its identity as a modern state. A lot of the legislators at this time really saw Michigan as a leader nationally. And it was also a time where Democrats controlled the Michigan state government. And so they were able to get some of this legislation through that today we might think would be very difficult to get through, considering sort of the more partisan nature of our politics.
How did Daisy Elliott's gifts manifest themselves during this time?
She was really known as a very hard worker. We have a quite charming political brochure of hers in our collection. And in it, she's telling people what she has to do every day as a legislator and making that work known, and included meeting with folks, speaking with constituents. She was always known as being there, being someone that people could count on. But she was also friendly to Republicans. She was someone who saw the need to really compromise and to reach across the aisle and bring people in that maybe you would think would be unlikely to support things like civil rights acts. But in actuality, I think most folks who run for public office are just trying to improve the lives of Michigan residents. So with knowing that she was someone who sort of wasn't like a shifty character, she was someone that you could really trust, I think was a great factor in her success.
It might be easy to say that the Elliot Larson Act might have just been a product of its times and needed to happen. But do you think that it really could have happened without Daisy Elliott at the helm?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, Mel Larson has talked about this quite a bit, and he said that if it wasn't for her and for her determination, I mean, she was elected in 63, and, you know, the Elliot Larson Act didn't pass until the late 1970s. So, you know, it took her a decade and a half to get this through. Not many people have that sort of persistence. I think the other thing to think about with regards to the Elliot Larson Act is that it's not only barring discrimination on the case of race, sex, religion, national origin, age, marital status. It also gives folks a place to air their grievances so that, you know, they can go report this. And also, it provides a framework for compensating victims of discrimination. Without some teeth to legislation for it to be enforced, it can really just be almost like a gesture to say, okay, we don't want discrimination in this state, but without some sort of enforcement of a law, it doesn't go very far to impact people's lives.
Jillian, thank you so much for talking with us a little bit about Daisy Elliott. She sounds like an amazing person.
Yes, she's quite inspirational, and we're very lucky to have had her serve the state.
Jillian Reese is curator of exhibits at the Michigan History Center.